Today we're going to study the entire chapter of Daniel 10, but I'm not going to deal with every word. And we're going to begin with a scripture reading from the New Testament. I'll be reading from 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 5 through 12. Do you not remember that while I was still with you, I was telling you these things? By these things, Paul's referring back to information he had given the church in Thessalonica on the second advent of Christ, as well as on the period of time in the tribulation where the church will be raptured, but the Antichrist will be active on the earth. He says, and you know what restrains him. You know what restrains him now, so that in his time he will be revealed. This is a reference to the Antichrist. For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Only he who now restrains will do so until he's taken out of the way. That's a reference to the rapture of the church and the work of the Holy Spirit through the church during the church age. Verse 8. Then that lawless one will be revealed, that's the Antichrist, whom the Lord will slay with the breath of his mouth and bring to an end by the appearance of his coming. This is not the rapture, but the second advent. That is, one whose coming is in accord with the activity of Satan, with all power and signs and false wonders, and with all the deception of wickedness for those who perish because they did not receive the love of the truth so as to be saved. And this is the verse I want to emphasize. For this reason, God will send upon them a deluding influence so that they will believe what is false. Let's read that again. God will send upon them, that is the unbelieving world, a deluding influence so that they will believe what is false, in order that they all may be judged who did not believe the truth, but took pleasure in wickedness. It's interesting when you read it slowly, isn't it? The Bible is very clear that beyond the realms of men and governments, there's a spiritual war in play. It's a war that predates the creation of man, and it's a war that will continue until the end of Christ's millennial reign, at which time God will cast Satan and his minions into the lake of fire. We call this war the angelic conflict. This is not a lesson about the angelic conflict per se, but it's a lesson that will reference the angelic conflict, and it will provide a glimpse into how this conflict is being played out in human history. By design, God's revelation to us through the scriptures is not exhaustive. That means that God has not seen fit to answer every question that the mind of man might be able to devise. There are going to be questions that we have for which we do not find answers in the scripture. An example of this is that God tells us very little about the original creation of the universe. That is, the universe that existed before Genesis chapter 1. It's clear that Genesis chapter 1 is not the account of the original creation. You can compare the language of Genesis 1:2 with Isaiah 45:18, and you can see that what is happening in Genesis 1 is a story of restoration. It's a story of restoration of the universe after some catastrophe has brought the universe into the condition of being formless and void. So this is just something that's, I have a lot of questions about that. I have very few answers because God doesn't provide them for us. There are allusions to the original creation in Scripture, primarily found in the book of Job and in the poetic literature of the Psalms. But we just have to accept the fact that God considered it more important to reveal information about the world in which we live than he did to inform us about a world that may have existed before the Genesis 1 restoration. Likewise, we're not told a lot about this war that raged in the heavens before man was created. Paul alludes to it in Ephesians chapter 6, verse 12, where he writes, "For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places." There's also an interesting account in 1 Kings chapter 22, where we have recorded the death of King Ahab. You may recall that Ahab is an evil king of the northern kingdom, and he had devised a plan to attack the king of Syria. Ahab was a man who had no interest in the truth. Like some of the kings we've actually studied in the book of Daniel, Ahab had an entire department within his administration called the DFP. It's the Department of False Prophets. Today we call it the media. Ahab had 400 false prophets on his payroll. That's quite a few. Now, the way you keep your job as a false prophet is you tell the king, who's your employer, what the king wants to hear, and you avoid the truth at all cost if the truth conflicts with what the king wants to hear. So Ahab told these false prophets about his plan to go up against the king of Syria, and they said to him in unison, "You bet. Go up to Syria. You'll be victorious." The problem is there was this other prophet named Micaiah. Ahab hated this man. He hated Micaiah because Micaiah was a true prophet and he told the truth. He was accustomed to telling Ahab the truth, even when the truth was not what the monarch wanted to hear. So I want to just look at a few verses that sort of play against, or with, actually, that verse I quoted from Ephesians. We're going to look at 1 Kings 22, beginning with verse 15. And I want to look at this for just a moment. The king addresses, and I'm sure this was reluctantly, he addresses Micaiah. And let's see what happens here, beginning with verse 15. "When he," that's the prophet Micaiah, "came to the king said to him, 'Micaiah, shall we go up Ramoth Gilead to battle, or shall we refrain?'" It's a yes or no question. "Shall we go up to battle the king of Syria or not?" Micaiah said, now you have to understand this is said with a great deal of sarcasm, "Go up, be successful. The Lord will give the king of Syria into your hands." Then the king said to him, "How many times must I adjure you to speak to me nothing but the truth in the name of the Lord?" So Micaiah said, "Fine. I saw all Israel scattered on the mountains like sheep which have no shepherd. And the Lord said, 'These have no master. Let each of them return to his house in peace.' Then the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, 'Didn't I tell you he would not prophesy good concerning me, but evil?'" So he asked Micaiah this question, "Shall I go fight against the king of Syria?" Micaiah answers with dripping sarcasm, "Absolutely, O king. Go up to Ramoth Gilead and attack Syria. The Lord will give victory into your hands." Ahab, though, isn't fooled. He knows Micaiah's mocking him and his staff of professional liars. So he says to Micaiah in verse 16, "You had better tell me the truth." And Micaiah does so in those next verses. The short version of Micaiah's prophecy to the king is this: if you go up against Syria, you aren't coming home alive. That's it. Now, that's scene one. It takes place in the palace. If this were a play, we would have two scenes in this play. We'd have scene one that takes place in the palace, and we'd have scene two that takes place in heaven. And this is what's interesting to me, because we're talking about a spiritual warfare that occurs in the heavenlies, according to Paul, not what we necessarily see happening here on the earth. So look at verse 19, because the scene has now shifted. Micaiah is now going to tell Ahab what he saw in his vision. Micaiah said, "Therefore, hear the word of the Lord." You want to hear the truth? Fine. Here it comes. "I saw the Lord sitting on his throne, and all the host of heaven were standing by him on his right and on his left. The Lord said, 'Who will entice Ahab to go up and fall at Ramoth Gilead?'" That's interesting. Who will entice him? One said this, and another said that. Then a spirit, that's all we know about this entity, a spirit came forward and stood before the Lord, and he said, "I'll do it. I'll entice him." The Lord said to the spirit, "How?" The spirit said, "I will go out and be a deceiving spirit." The Hebrew word for deceiving means lying. "I will be a lying spirit in the mouth of all his prophets," all 400 of those guys. Then he said, "You're to go entice him. Go, prevail, go and do it." Listen to this. Now therefore, behold, the Lord has put a lying spirit in the mouth of all these your prophets, and the Lord has proclaimed disaster against you. That's pretty interesting. There's this discussion that goes on in heaven, and in this discussion, the Lord asks the question, which I think a lot of people will find troubling. The Lord said, who will entice Ahab to go up and fall, die, at Ramoth-Gilead? Well, this stirs up a discussion in heaven, presumably among the angels, until a spirit comes forward and he says, I'll entice him. Here's how I picture this happening. The Lord asks the question, who will entice Ahab? Discussion breaks out among the angels that in this proverbial movie scene builds up to a low roar. Then someone speaks, I'll entice him. And the room falls silent. Everyone looks at the spirit. What's the spirit going to say next? He says, I'll deceive the king so that he does the very thing that will bring about his death. I'll do it. Well, who do you suppose this is? Who volunteered before the Lord to deceive the king? Well, he's called the spirit in verse 21. The word for spirit is ruach. This one is called ha-ruach, which means it is the spirit. It carries the definite article. And when the spirit, ruach, is written with the definite article, theoretically, it could refer to the spirit of God. But why is that not possible here? Well, it isn't possible here because in verses 22 and 23 of 1 Kings 22, this same spirit is called a lying spirit. And there are two things we know from the scriptures that bear on the identification of this spirit. First is we know that God cannot lie. We are told in Titus chapter 1, verse 2, God cannot lie. God cannot lie because God cannot act contrary to his nature, and his nature is one of truthfulness and veracity. Here's the second thing. We know that Satan is called the father of lies in John chapter 8. Jesus speaks of Satan like this. He says, whenever he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own nature. For he is a liar and the father of lies. So I want you to notice, if you compare Titus 1:2 and John 8, both God and Satan speak from their own natures. God from his nature of truthfulness, Satan from his nature as the great deceiver. So this spirit can't be the spirit of God. This spirit must be, I believe, one of the angels that followed Satan in his rebellion against the Lord before the creation of man. And before the event that disrupted the universe that is restored in Genesis chapter 1. Now, as this unfolds, you get this glimpse behind the cosmic curtain, if you want to think of it that way. And you see that God, this is an interesting concept, and it's not an easy concept, God is able to use evil for his own purposes while remaining untainted by it. While this lying spirit spoke through Ahab's false prophets, all 400 of them, the Lord clearly laid out the truth for Ahab through the words of Micaiah. And that's very important to understand. But Ahab had a choice. He could listen to the words of the false prophet that he knew were contrary to God's will, or he could believe Micaiah, who spoke the words he did not want to hear. And that speaks to Ahab's nature. The decision Ahab makes grows out of his own nature. His own nature is to reject the truth and to believe the lie. Just as Paul said, God will put a deceiving spirit in them so that they will believe what is false. God himself never lies. He is the source of truth, and yet he permits lying. He permits Satan to act in accordance with his own nature. He allows these false prophets to be deceived. We saw that in the opening scripture reading, and we see it here. In the case of Ahab, God allowed a demonic force to perform an act that was natural to that demonic force, the act of deception based on a lie. And in doing so, God set in motion his plan that led to the death of Ahab. We're about to see the same thing taking place in the times of the Gentiles as they're laid out for us in this fourth and final vision of Daniel. Daniel chapter 10 takes place 2 years after the revelation of chapter 9. The last time we were together, which seems like eons ago, we studied the revelation of Daniel chapter 9. What we're studying today in chapter 10 takes place 2 years after the revelation of chapter 9, and it covers almost the same periods of history set forth by the vision in chapter 8. There are more details that we will see as we move through this fourth vision than we saw previously, but it's still dealing with primarily the Medo-Persian Empire, followed by the Greek Empire, and then it jumps to the time of the Great Tribulation that will follow the Church Age. But we're spared in this fourth vision some of the symbolism that we've kind of become accustomed to. We don't see the symbolism of the great statue of chapter 2, nor do we see the strange animal symbolisms of chapter 7. Here the revelation is given in terms that are pretty straightforward. So these last chapters of Daniel, 10, 11, and 12, which will finish the book, deal with Daniel's fourth vision. And here's how they break down. Chapter 10 describes the coming of a heavenly messenger who gives the revelation or the prophecy to Daniel. And this will be our topic today. Chapter 11 then begins the predictive section of Daniel's fourth vision. And then finally, chapter 12 continues the story of the Great Tribulation, adding some chronological details and eventually drawing the book of Daniel to a close. So let's look at verse 1 of chapter 10. In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a message was revealed to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar. And the message was true and one of great conflict, but he understood the message and had an understanding of the vision. The third year of King Cyrus is the date of the beginning of this vision. That would be 536 to 535 BC. If we were to read forward to verse 4, we'll learn there that an angel appeared to Daniel on the 24th day of the first month on the Jewish calendar, which would be Nisan 24. Note that this fourth vision came approximately 2 years after many of the Jewish exiles were permitted to return to Judah. Cyrus, the Persian king, issued a decree in 538 BC allowing the exiles to return to their homeland, and you can find a reference to the decree of Cyrus in 2 Chronicles chapter 36, verses 22 through 23. So Cyrus played a very important role in God's plan of bringing back and restoring Israel to the promised land. It's obvious that Daniel had not returned to Judah with these exiles. When the vision takes place, we're going to see that he was on the banks of the Tigris River, a river that originates a few hundred miles to the north of Babylon, and it runs east of the city of Babylon, at times coming within about 20 miles of Babylon, other times being a little farther away than that. The Euphrates River, on the other hand, runs straight through the city of Babylon, so obviously Daniel's not in Babylon proper. He is someplace east of the city, and he is on the banks of the Tigris River. And the important point to note here is that he's not in Judah. He did not go back to Judah as he could have under the decree of Cyrus. I think there are two reasons for that. First and foremost was his age. Daniel would have been in his mid-80s and the trip would have been quite difficult for him. But he also held a fairly high office in the Persian government, and that may have prevented him from leaving his service to King Cyrus. In any case, he's not among the Jews who returned to Judah. Now, there's a hint. It's just a hint in verse 1 that we should be thinking about the angelic conflict when we study this. The hint is the word that's translated, not surprisingly, conflict, but that's not the reason I think it refers to the angelic conflict. The word is zabah. The word means army. It's the same word that in the plural occurs in the divine name Adonai Sabaoth, Lord of hosts, where hosts is a reference to the heavenly host, that is to angels. So the hosts are the army of angels who serve God. The conflict alluded to is a spiritual conflict that will have earthly implications, and we'll see those. Let's look at verses 2 and 3. In those days, I, Daniel, had been mourning for 3 entire weeks. I didn't eat any tasty food, nor did meat or wine enter my mouth, nor did I use any ointment until the entire 3 weeks were completed. Daniel had been engaging in a sort of semi-fasting for 3 weeks, at the end of which time he received this revelation. The fast was not a complete fast. He didn't eliminate all foods, but he did exclude meat and wine. Verse 4. On the 24th day of the first month, while I was by the bank of the great river, that is the Tigris, I lifted my eyes and looked, and behold, there was a certain man dressed in linen, whose waist was girded with a belt of pure gold of Uphaz. Uphaz is probably a region. We don't know exactly where it is. It was probably a region known for high-quality gold. So when we read gold of Uphaz, it's gold from that region that was mined there. Verse 6, his body also was like beryl. His face had the appearance of lightning. His eyes were like flaming torches. His arms and feet like the gleam of polished bronze, and the sound of his words like the sound of a great tumult. Now I, Daniel alone, saw the vision, while the men who were with me did not see the vision. Nevertheless, a great dread fell on them, and they ran away to hide. So I was left alone and saw this great vision, yet no strength was left in me, for my natural color turned to a deathly pallor, and I retained no strength. But I heard the sound of the words, and as soon as I heard the sound of the words, I fell into a deep sleep on my face, with my face to the ground. On Nisan 24, this heavenly personage appears to Daniel. It's not mentioned per se, but if a Jewish reader at the time were reading this text, it would be clear that the fasting that Daniel did was associated with the preparation for and the celebration of Passover. Daniel had been focused on spiritual things since the third day of Nisan, and Passover would have been on the 14th of Nisan, followed by the week-long feast of unleavened bread. All these things have just been concluded. And the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread are behind him. And then this angel appears, or this heavenly being appears to Daniel, and the revelation is then given to him. The messenger who appears to Daniel, and who's described in terms that can only indicate a higher order of being rather than a mere man, is unnamed. We're not given the identity of this one. Some have tried to make the case that this too is Gabriel. You know, Gabriel has been a part of previous visions to Daniel. I think it's odd that if this is Gabriel at this point, that he wouldn't have been named. So I don't believe this is Gabriel. Others have argued that this one dressed in white linen represents a Christophany, a manifestation in Old Testament times of the pre-incarnate Christ. At first glance, it may not seem so, but as you read through this chapter and you examine it closely, there are several different heavenly beings who play different roles in this vision, and I want to quickly point them out to you. There is this one clothed in white linen, described in verses 5 through 9. His description leads me to believe that this is in fact a Christophany, a manifestation of the pre-incarnate Christ. This description is quite similar to descriptions that we find in the book of Revelation. But also notice Daniel's reaction to the manifestation. He says, no strength was left in him after seeing this person, in verse 8. The phrase in my NASB translation, my natural color turned to a deathly pallor, reads in Hebrew, my splendor was changed to ruin. So we see here that Daniel's reaction to this manifestation is very extreme. Also, the encounter results in Daniel falling into a deep sleep. The term that is used here, fall into a deep sleep, is the Hebrew term radam. And from that verb, there is a word tardima, which refers to the deep sleep that God caused to fall on Adam when he took his rib to form Eve. When we read about this, this is a type of sleep that is induced by God. And it is not just a matter of falling asleep because you were tired. It is more like it's something different than that. I don't know what it is, but it is something that God causes. Beyond this, I can't help but look at this, read these texts, and think of Saul's encounter with the risen Christ on the road to Damascus. You can read about that yourselves in Acts chapter 9, the first seven verses. But this sounds very much like this. Daniel sees this manifestation. The people who are with him do not, and yet they have a sense that something's happening. This is very similar to what happens to Saul and his companions as they walk on the road to Damascus. So let me just mention the other heavenly beings here quickly, and then we'll address them later. In verses 10 through 14, we have what I'm going to call the unnamed interpreting angel. I'll be referring to the interpreting angel. This is the same angel who will appear later in chapter 10, and he will also appear in chapters 11 and 12. He will be the heavenly being, or the angel, the one who will give the prophetic interpretation to Daniel. So you'll hear me refer to the interpreting angel, and that's what I'm referring to, is this being that is described in verses 10 through 14. In verses 13 and 21, we see Michael the archangel. He appears in the context of giving support to the interpreting angel in those verses. When we get to chapter 12, verse 5, we'll see two others are mentioned standing by the river. And then we have to account also for two beings called the Prince of Persia in verses 13 and 20, and the Prince of Greece that's also mentioned in verse 20. So there are a number of heavenly beings that play roles in chapter 10, 11, and 12. So let's continue thinking about the first being, the one that I've suggested is the pre-incarnate Christ. Daniel is extremely emphatic that he alone encountered Christ in the fullness of this manifestation. The Hebrew text of verse 7 reads like this, "And I saw, I Daniel, I alone, the appearance." Word order and repetition are far more important in the Hebrew language than they are in the English language. So it's Daniel's intent here to emphasize that this encounter was specifically for him. It's fair to ask why. Why did the other people who were with Daniel not see this manifestation, which I believe was a Christophany? I guess we could speculate. We might argue that his companions were not believers and therefore were not deemed worthy. This would be the case certainly with Saul and his companions. They were on the way to persecute the church. Saul is not a believer. Christ, for a very specific purpose, appears to Saul. And Paul is saved on the road to Damascus, but his counterparts, we're not told, were saved. They didn't experience the manifestation of Christ in the same way that Saul did, and that seems to be the case here as well. Dr. Walbert at Dallas Seminary suggests that this appearance was intended for Daniel alone, and he leaves it at that and doesn't try to speculate beyond that point, and we'll do the same. Let's move on at verse 10, because here it begins to get, I think, quite interesting. Verses 10 through 14. "Then behold, a hand touched me and set me trembling on my hands and knees. He said to me," that is the one who touched him, I believe the interpreting angel, "O Daniel, man of high esteem, understand the words that I'm about to tell you and stand upright, for I've now been sent to you. And when he had spoken this word to me, I stood up trembling. Then he said to me, don't be afraid, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart on understanding this and on humbling yourself before God, your words were heard, and I have come in response to those words. I've come in response to your prayer. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia was withstanding me for 21 days. Then behold, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I had been left there with the kings of Persia." If you're reading from an NIV, your text says the king of Persia, which sort of implies Cyrus, but the Hebrew text reads kings, plural. So that can't refer to Cyrus. Verse 14. "Now I've come to give you an understanding of what will happen to your people," that would be Israel, the believing Jews, those that are still in Babylon, but certainly those who have returned back to the promised land. "I've come to give you an understanding of what will happen to your people in the latter days, for the vision pertains to the days yet future." So that's a very important verse in this chapter. This is the verse that gives us the reason that the subsequent verses and chapters are being revealed. It is so Daniel will have a sense of knowledge about what is going to happen to Israel over the times of the Gentiles. We encounter here in verse 10 and through 14 this second heavenly being that I've called the interpreting angel. He remains unnamed. It's he who touches Daniel, who rouses him from this deep sleep that came upon him as a result of the Christophany. This second angel addresses Daniel, tells him to stand up, and he informs Daniel that he's come to him in response to the prayer. This, to me, is the first indication that this is a different being from the one described above. Christ was sent into the world by the Father to give his life for the sins of the world. But I can't think of an occasion in Scripture when the second person of the Trinity is sent by God to do anything else, certainly not to deliver a simple prophetic message. This seems to be the role of an angel. We come to the verse that relates, I think, to the story of King Ahab. You may have wondered, why in the world did we talk about Ahab in the beginning of this lesson? Well, I think verse 13 has a relationship, not necessarily specifically to Ahab, but to things that occurred in those verses we read. Verse 13 mentions three persons of interest: the prince of the kingdom of Persia, Michael, one of the chief princes, and then this group called the kings of Persia. Not the king of Persia, but the kings of Persia. Now, we've already learned from Ephesians 6 that there is a spiritual battle underway that involves Satan and the angels that followed him in his rebellion. From 1 Kings 22, we learned that some aspects of this angelic conflict are being played out in human history. It was played out in the case of Ahab. This is important because if you don't understand that much, if not all, of what's taking place in the world in which we live is directly related to the angelic conflict, you'll miss the glimpse behind the curtain provided here in Daniel's fourth vision. In the account of Ahab and the deceiving spirit, let's think about that for a moment. God puts forth the question, who will entice Ahab to go and fall at Ramoth-Gilead? This tells us that God's plan involved ending the reign of Ahab. God's plan involved taking Ahab out of play. God used agents to bring this plan into completion. We've learned that God's actions occur in the realm of human governments. If you look back in Daniel chapter 2, verse 21, there we read that it is God who changes the times and epochs. He removes kings and he establishes kings. Isn't that exactly what he did with Ahab? He took him out. He took out Nebuchadnezzar. In fact, when we studied Daniel chapter 4, we saw this principle in play in microcosm, because Nebuchadnezzar had a dream about a great tree. And as the tree was cut down and stripped of its foliage, so Nebuchadnezzar was deposed and made to live as an animal in the fields of Babylon. From this event, Nebuchadnezzar learned that it is God, not the king, who's in control of human history. And this is, in fact, then the macro perspective of human history. And that's what took place in 1 Kings chapter 22 with Ahab. So how in the world is all this related to the prince of Persia, Michael, and the kings of Persia? Well, the visions of Daniel have to do with the flow of history during the times of the Gentiles. To depose Ahab, God used human agents. What human agents did he use? He used the false prophets, 400 of them. He used human agents who were deceived by a spiritual agent. The spiritual agent is simply referred to as a spirit in 1 Kings 22:21. In Daniel 10, the prince of Persia and the kings of Persia are demonic forces assigned to direct the affairs of those empires during the times of the Gentiles. And as I pointed out, the NIV says king of Persia. It is actually kings of Persia. The Hebrew is plural. So this is not a reference to Cyrus. Persia happens to be the sphere of influence, and these, we'll call them angels, fallen angels, are given limited authority over the leaders and the people of that region. If you read John Walvoord on this, again, the former president of Dallas Seminary, here's what he writes. The prince of Persia, is not the human king of Persia, but rather the angelic leader of Persia, a fallen angel under the direction of Satan, in contrast to the angelic prince Michael, who leads and protects Israel. It's clear the prince of Persia and the kings of Persia, and by extension later the prince of Greece, we'll read about him in verse 20, are fallen angels because the prince of Persia opposes the messenger of the Lord for 21 days. So these princes are powerful beings, they are powerful spirits, they are powerful angels who were able to resist the interpreting angel for 21 days until Michael the archangel intervened. We're not told why this standoff took place, but I don't think it's that hard to surmise that it was related to the content of Daniel's prayer that he had prayed over the period of the last 3 weeks. Remember, this is a very important time in the life of the Jewish people. It's the time of the preparation for the Passover, the week of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. This has gone on for 3 weeks. This is a very important time. Daniel is focused on spiritual things. And what we have to do is say, what has been Daniel's primary concern? What has caught his interest? What has he been concerned with? What is the nature of his prayer? Well, his prayer, I'm sure, was for the welfare of the Jewish people. Back in Judah, many of these refugees, many of these exiles have gone home, and under the assistance of Cyrus, they've been given the right to rebuild the city and to rebuild the temple, but the Samaritans were opposing this. There was a great deal of tension going on. The people of the land didn't want the Jews to come back and rebuild the city of Jerusalem and rebuild the temple. In order for this to be successful, the Jewish people needed the continued support of Cyrus in order to guarantee a favorable outcome. This may have been the issue. Will Cyrus continue to support the Jews and the restoration of Jerusalem, or will he be influenced by the prince of Persia to turn his back on the Jewish people? This was the essence of Daniel's prayer and probably the cause for this particular spiritual battle that was taking place, if we use Paul's words, a struggle against world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in heavenly places. Paul clearly ties the spiritual battle to what he calls world forces of this darkness. In other words, what's taking place in the world is not independent from what's taking place in the spiritual realm, but is in fact driven by it. This is what's in play in Daniel chapter 10, in the 6th century B.C. world at Babylon. Certainly Satan works against men in the personal realm. And if you read Job chapter 1, you'll see that the personal attack against a godly man named Job also was related to the angelic conflict. The attack on Job is devised in the presence of God, Satan, and the angelic host, Job 1, verse 6. And this whole affair is cast in the context of the question, can a man created lower than the angels be faithful to God even in times of duress? That's the question. This is the key to the book of Job. It's also a key concept in trying to understand why God allows evil. The struggles of Job answer the question, are the powers of darkness a match for the powers of light? In our context, could the interpreting angel have lost the struggle with the prince of Persia? Well, the answer is no, he could not. Because he who is in you is more powerful than he who is in the world. The forces of darkness are strong. They're stronger than you and they're stronger than I. But the one they oppose, the Lord of hosts, is not. He's omnipotent. All that he has decreed will come to pass. So Satan does in fact attack us on a personal level. And even that can be related to the angelic conflict. But Satan also is active in the realm of human governments, and that's what's in view in Daniel chapter 10. Daniel began praying for Israel on Nisan 3, third day of the month, before the Passover, before the Feast of Unleavened Bread. But the answer to his prayer was delayed by this prince of Persia. The interpreting angel says, "This one withstood me for 21 days until Michael came to my aid." Michael is the archangel. The word Michael, the name Michael, means "who is like God," with the presumed answer, "Well, no one. God is unique." He's the archangel. He is another of the heavenly beings mentioned in Daniel chapter 10. The archangel means the chief angel. He seems to be more powerful than the interpretive angel, for he comes to the aid of the interpretive angel. Apparently, in the same sense that there is an angel with chief influence over Persia and also over Greece, Michael is the angel who looks after and who is, in effect, the prince of Israel. He is responsible for working in human affairs with the nation of Israel. He's referred later as your prince. Michael, your prince. Your prince doesn't refer to Daniel as an individual, but to Israel, Daniel's people for whom he has been praying. Michael is, in effect, the prince of Israel. Here's what seems to be taking place. God has been laying out for Daniel the succession of Gentile kingdoms that will exert power over his people Israel during the times of the Gentiles. First was the Chaldean Empire, followed by the Medo-Persian Empire, mentioned in connection with her angel of influence, the prince of the kingdom of Persia. Persia will be followed by Greece, a nation also under the influence of an angel called the Prince of Greece. And then Greece will be followed by Rome. And as we've seen already in previous lessons, Rome will be influenced significantly by Satan himself through his agent, the Antichrist, during the tribulation period. But the mention of these princes, by them we're to understand that the oppression of God's people, anti-Semitism, if you will, is satanic in origin, and there are spiritual forces at work behind the scenes. Now, verse 14 gives the reason for the revelation, to give Daniel an understanding of what will happen to the Jews in the latter days, in days that are yet future. And this is actually the crux of the chapter. So let's finish the chapter by looking at verse 15, and we'll read through the end of the chapter. "When he had spoken to me according to these words, I turned my face toward the ground and became speechless. And behold, one who resembled a human being was touching my lips. Then I opened my mouth and spoke and said to him who was standing before me, 'O my Lord,'" and here the word is equivalent of our word, sir, "O my Lord, as a result of the vision, anguish has come upon me, and I've retained no strength. For how can such a servant of my Lord talk with one such as my Lord? As for me, there remains just now no strength in me, nor has any breath been left in me. Then this one with human appearance touched me again and strengthened me. He said, 'O man of high esteem, do not be afraid. Peace be with you. Take courage and be courageous.' Now as soon as he spoke to me, I received strength and said, 'May my Lord speak, for you have strengthened me.' Then he said, 'Do you understand why I came to you? But I shall now return to fight against the prince of Persia. So I'm going forth, and behold, the prince of Greece is about to come. However, I will tell you what is inscribed in the writing of truth. Yet there is no one who stands firmly with me against these forces except Michael, your prince," the prince of Israel. So this is the reason for the revelation. Twice in these verses, this angel is referred to one who looked like a man, or in words that are similar to this. I think it's interesting to compare the twice repeated description, one who looks like a man, referring to the interpretive angel, with the description of the pre-incarnate Christ in verses 5 and 6. You can't look at those two descriptions and not conclude that these are different persons. Also, three times Daniel refers to this one by the term Adonai. Adonai, it's the equivalent of our term, sir. It's not necessarily a divine title, for the divine title we would expect to see Adonai, not Adonai. So this is not a reference to God, it's a reference to another being of heavenly origin. Nevertheless, Daniel is left without strength, and he had to be revived by the angel. When the angel touched Daniel's lips, he was strengthened so that once again he could speak. There's further evidence that this angel is found in Daniel's rhetorical question, how can such a servant of my Lord talk to one such as my Lord? He simply means, how can a human being, a mortal man like me, speak with a heavenly being such as yourself? How is this possible? Well, we see here a common refrain when angels speak to men. They typically say, don't be afraid. We find that in verses 12 and 19. The angel then follows this with the word shalom. Peace be with you. Shalom, among other things, can be thought of as the opposite of fear. So when the angel is wishing peace upon Daniel, he's emphasizing that Daniel need not fear the presence of this angel. The angel inquires whether Daniel understands why he's come. It's a rhetorical question because he doesn't give Daniel an opportunity to answer. Rather, he immediately says, I must return to the fight. Presumably the fight with this prince of Persia. Seems very clear to me that the angel is asking Daniel if he understands the angelic conflict, if he understands the spiritual realities that underlie all the troubles that will be brought on the Jews by the hand of Gentiles during the times of the Gentiles. The Persians and the Greeks, and after them the Romans, will persecute the Jews, and behind all this persecution, behind the mistreatment of the Jews by the Gentile world forces, there are the spiritual forces of wickedness that Paul mentioned in his letter to Ephesus. The angel says, I have to go fight. He uses the word laham. And he writes it in what we call the reflexive form, indicating that the angel himself will be actively involved in opposing the prince of Persia. Then he warns Daniel that after the rule of Persia ends, the prince of Greece will follow in the same ancient footsteps to bring more persecution on the Jews. These actors, Satan's agents, will change, but the purpose behind the persecution will be the same. In verse 21, the angel mentions the writing of truth, and then he says, there's no one who stands firmly with me against these except Michael, your prince. The writing of truth is a metaphor for God's irrevocable plan that's established as part of the divine decree mentioned elsewhere in Scripture and is the basis for his covenants with Israel. The speaker here is the interpretive angel, and Michael is the prince of Israel, the angel assigned to oversee and protect God's covenant people. He's the archangel, which should tell us something about the fate of those who will oppose Israel in years to come. In conclusion, I want to read Daniel 11:1. In the first year of Darius the Mede, I arose to be an encouragement and a protection for him. In the Masoretic text, the Septuagint, and our English translations, they all end chapter 10 with verse 21, and they begin chapter 11 with what your Bibles indicate as verse 1 of chapter 11. The reason for this division at verse 21 is obvious. Chapter 11 begins with another date that's 2 years prior to the date given in Daniel 10:1. But the Lutheran commentator, H.C. Leupold, writes this. He says, nothing could be clearer than that this verse still belongs to what was just considered. So I agree with him. I think Daniel 11:1 should end chapter 10 and not begin chapter 11, and it should be interpreted as follows. So let's start with the date. The first year of Darius the Mede. Now remember this, the first year of Darius the Mede and the first year of Cyrus the Great are the same year, 538 to 537 BC. Something happened then that was related to the angelic conflict. What events in that time frame, the 538-537 BC time frame, would have been significant to the Israelites and would have elicited such a strong satanic opposition? Well, there are at least two very significant events that occurred, either of which or both of which may have been the motivation for this escalation of Satan's opposition to God's plan. One, the fall of the Chaldean Empire to Persia, over which the prince of Persia had influence, occurred at the end of 539 BC. But more importantly, the new Persian leader, Cyrus, who was leading the leader and king of Persia, where the Jews had been kept captive, Cyrus issued a decree freeing the Jews, allowing them to return to Jerusalem to rebuild the city and the temple in 538 BC. These events caused an intense spiritual conflict that took place during the first year of Cyrus and Darius. It involved Michael because he's Israel's prince, and all these things involved the Jewish people. I think the intense conflict was over the heart of Cyrus. It was over Cyrus and his decree to free the Jews from captivity. Gleason Archer makes this comment: "Knowing that such a development could lead to the ultimate appearance of the Son of God as the Messiah for Israel's redeemed, Satan and all his hosts were determined to thwart the renewal of Israel and the deliverance of its people from destruction." Stephen Miller sums up Archer's conclusion as follows. He says, "In this passage, humanity is afforded a glimpse of the behind-the-scenes activity that took place in the Persian government. Cyrus released the Jews, but unknown to the Persian monarch, angelic forces played a part in his decision. Satan and his demons had been bound so that the will of God would be accomplished." Now, the vision proper will begin in verse 2 of chapter 11, and that'll be our subject next week.